Okay. So let's move on then to what does the MMCD provide? Well, we provide an integrated set of documents, and we provide some training courses to help you use them appropriately. There's a document now called the User Guide, which is appropriate for both contract administrators, for people who are preparing tenders, and for superintendents on the job if they want to know the background for some of the clauses and what's anticipated, what's expected. That's what we call Volume 1. Then there's Volume 2, the big book, the bound book that forms the guts of the standard contract. We also provide a client consultant agreement, and I believe this is under review by one of the committees, but this is a standard document that's appropriate for a municipality to hire a consultant to manage the job. We have a design guideline manual for the municipal staff who are setting up requirements for designers. And although I don't have a copy of it here, there's a green design guideline which incorporates some of the options that are available for the various LEED standards. We've also got a utilities best practice, because one of the common problems that contractors and owners have throughout the province is getting the utilities moved out of the way. And so we have a set of guidelines for a protocol to give people some moral suasion to get everybody working together to solve that problem. We do four courses, but really only two very often. This introduction to the MMCD was more common in the 1990s when people were not very familiar with the documents, so we did it more often then. And as we go forward and this becomes a webinar, we may find that we don't do it too much anymore. We then have a two-day contract administrator certification course, and this is intended specifically for people who are writing contracts for municipalities or administering MMCD contracts in the field. And one day of that is on each of those halves of that topic. Then we have a one-day course for contractor superintendents to bring them up to speed in more detail than today's course would do on the ins and outs of managing a contract from a contractor's perspective, things to watch out for, some guidelines and checklists. And then there is a final course which we almost never run to certify referees, and there is quite a screening procedure before you can be accepted into that course. So those are the four courses that we offer. In addition, we've started to do some shorter webinars. We had one that's now on our website, had it a couple months ago, on legal aspects of tendering. And you can just click on to our website and go to that one and watch it at your convenience. So moving on then to some of the more elemental parts of the MMCD. Why did we make it a unit price contract? We're often asked, can you give us a lump sum contract? Well, the purpose, as I stated earlier, is to deal with a very narrow set of municipal construction problems, the stuff that's generally below ground. And because it's below ground, it's very difficult to anticipate the problems that you're going to encounter, whether it's rock that you didn't anticipate, whether it's water conditions that you didn't anticipate, whether it's bad soil conditions that you couldn't anticipate, whether it's interference with existing utilities that weren't marked on drawings properly, whatever. There's a lot of things that can affect an underground contract that make it much more appropriate for a unit price bidding than if you were building something where you have a lot more control once you're out of the ground. So unit price contracts are appropriate when quantity determinations are difficult, when there are unknown conditions to be encountered, where site decisions have to be made and made rapidly to keep the job running smoothly. And also, unit price contracts tend to reduce the bid risk for contracts at little cost to the owners. So, by and large, we anticipate the schedule of quantities and prices for an MMCD contract will be primarily unit price. There will, of course, be some fixed price or lump sum items in that, as there always is. But the intent is not to create a total lump sum contract. And in fact, the price that's tendered is acknowledged to be only for comparison purposes to other bidders, that the final price the owner pays will never be the amount that was tendered. The MMCD is not particularly suitable for fixed price contracts, given the pervasive nature of the risk sharing that we built into the contract language to deal with unforeseen events. It doesn't make a good fixed price contract. And consultants who've tried to modify the document to create a fixed price contract have repeatedly stumbled by missing some of the risk sharing elements. However, having said that, at some point, Lillooet used our documents to buy a fire truck, and apparently we're satisfied with the results. I've never seen that contract, but I thought it was a rather novel use of the new document, because this was back in the 90s. So, moving on to the documents themselves, what I've done in the next couple of slides is identified the different documents, who sets up the format, and who sets up the content. And you'll see the answers there are color-coded. The invitation to tender, the MMCD creates the format, and the owner fills in the contract. In other words, what's the name of the contract? When does it close? Who's the contact person, etc. The instructions to tenders are very similar. Part one, the unique portion that relates to the specifics of a given contract, we do the format and the owner does the unique components. The standard portion, we do the format, and both the owner and the MMCD handle the content. And I say the owner because the owner has an ability to modify the standard portion by writing special conditions into the unique portion. Any addenda that come out during tendering are entirely created by the owner, both content and format. The form of tender Michael, my pointer's not coming on here. Okay. The form of tender is a document that the owner creates to standardize the responses of the bidders. We create the format and the content of it. But once we get into the schedules, the appendices, there's a mixed sharing of the work. If we look at the schedule of quantities and prices, we set up the standard format. The owner chooses which ones apply to the job, fills in the quantities, and then the tenderer responds with the prices. So you can see here that the form of tender has a number of things that the tenderer has to respond to. The schedule, the prices, of course. The preliminary schedule, how are they going to do the job? Do they commit to meeting the timeline? The experience of the superintendent. This is one of the ways where the owner starts to get some involvement in choosing the quality of the people that will be doing the job. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Similarly, the experience of the contractor. The owner gets to evaluate the information that the tenderer provides as part of the award evaluation. And the Appendix 5, the list of subcontractors. Now, owners are supposed to require this, and they're supposed to evaluate them at the time of the tender award process. The form of agreement is the next major document, and we create the format in all, not only the agreement, but its two schedules. The owner and the tenderer complete the contract of the form of agreement, and the owner determines what are the list of the contract documents and what are the list of the contract drawings. And it is only these documents and drawings that the contractor must comply with during the construction of the project. Doesn't matter what information was in the reference documents, that's not relevant once you get into construction. The next major group of documents are the general conditions. And again, that's essentially the pink pages in this volume 2. Any supplementary general conditions are created by the owner, and their content is determined by the owner. Standard specifications are created by the MMCD, and we create the content for the standards. But any supplementaries are created by the owner or the owner and their consultant working together. The standard detail drawings, as I mentioned, these were one of the things that we created early on, both the format and the content. But any supplementaries are modified and created by the owner and the consultant. And then finally, the design drawings are created by typically the consultant for the owner. And all of those documents go together to make a tender package and eventually a contract package. Now, I did note in a footnote here that sometimes owners have two sets. They'll have a set of unique specifications that are really only apply to one job, and they'll have another set which they use every time. So, for example, they might have a specification that says, in this municipality, any references to type 10 Portland cement shall be replaced with type 30 Portland cement, or whatever it is. And they will use that every time. They might have a unique requirement that says the water main at station 4 plus 33 is to be made of, or to use XYZ brand of fitting. So we encourage owners to keep all of their supplementaries in one group rather than to split them into standard and unique. But that's up to the municipality on how they handle it. Now, we've talked, or I've listed a whole bunch of documents And I said right at the beginning that part of making this thing work is to have the players understand the rules of the game. And you couldn't play a game of cards if you didn't know the ranking of the cards. You can't build a contract if you don't know the ranking of the documents. So in our general condition GC 2.2.4, we list what trumps another document. The highest level is the agreement. The agreement between the owner and the contractor and the attached schedules is the highest level. And that document cannot be changed without agreement of both parties. The addenda, it's the second level. Then you get into the supplementary general conditions that have been issued, the general conditions, the supplementary specs, the specs, the drawings and schedules, two of the agreement, supplementary detailed drawings, standard detailed drawings, form of tender, instructions to tenders, and all other contract documents at the bottom. So why do you need this? Anybody got a guess? Why would we need a hierarchy of documents?
If there is a dispute or difference of opinion, you have to start with the top level of the hierarchy with the documents. What does that document say? If there is a discrepancy between some supplementary detail drawing and the contract one, you have to know which one supersedes which one.
Exactly right. You only need to look at them where there's some discrepancy between two documents, and you need to know which one to follow. You go to this this GC clause, and you see which one ranks higher. And that whatever ranks higher sets what the contractor has to do. So it only works when there's a conflict of instructions between two document levels. The problem is more complicated when there is a conflict between information in documents at the same level. So say you get one drawing that says this, and you get a note on another drawing that seems to contradict it. What happens then?
Why is it that the time of tender you ask for clarification?
Yes.
Later on, then,
yeah, exactly. If you identify it at the time of tendering, then you ask for clarification. But once you're into the contract, if you come across it, the interesting decision of the courts is that the contractor gets to choose. And the reason for that is that the contractor did not have any ability to create the documents or to even modify the documents during tendering, whereas the owner had however long they wanted to get it right. And so the legal principle that applies is that the party that did not create the documents gets to have their reasonable interpretation upheld. Yes? What if both are wrong? Well, let me follow through my analogy a little bit and maybe it'll answer your question. So what typically will happen is there'll be a conflict and the CA will say, well, no, you have to do this. And the contractor says, no, I bid it to do this. And the CA says, well, I don't care. This is what I want. Well, the CA gets to make the call. The problem is that the CA doesn't understand that if his or her choice, costs the contractor more money, then the owner is obligated to pay the contractor that extra money, because it's absolutely appropriate for a contractor to pick the least expensive option to maximize their chances of getting the tender award. If there was no way to determine, then the contractor gets to choose the the cheaper one, and the owner has to pay the difference. So the same thing would happen in answer to your question, that if both were wrong, the CA could set whatever the appropriate answer is, but would have to pay whatever the contractor can document as a legitimate difference in cost. I see we've got a question here that was sent in a bit earlier. For all of the instances where the owner is noted as responsible, can these duties always be performed by a consultant on the owner's behalf, or just some of the time? Okay. Sorry I didn't get that when it came up, but the answer is most of the time. The owner is limited in the number of things that the owner can do directly, and it basically comes down to dealing with funding matters and dispute resolution. In almost everything else, the CA has been delegated to handle the problem in the first instance. So typically, owners don't have a lot of direct involvement in these contracts if they're being managed properly, if the CA understands the scope and role that they are to fulfill. They can take instructions from the owner, providing those instructions do not conflict with the contract language. Hope that answered your question, Brad. So I mentioned before that the agreement is the number one document. It's the ace. And once it's signed, it becomes the core element of the contract. It sets out all of the other things that will flow from it. And because of this, it's the only document that takes two-party agreement to change. And in the rare circumstances where the agreement has to be changed, the MMCD recommends that the owners notify the contractor's bonding company at the same time so that there's no potential for a bonding company to say, well, we didn't understand that was part of the agreement when we agreed to bond. So the owner creates, as I showed earlier, a number of alterations or insertions to the documents to make a complete tender or contract package. They have to create the special tendering instructions, whatever those may be. They may create supplementary general conditions. In fact, every municipality that I know of creates some supplementary conditions. Some municipalities have a page or two or three. Other municipalities have a book that's as thick as our document here. Obviously, we like to see the minimum number of supplementals because the more there are, the less the benefit of standardization. Similarly, supplemental specifications. There's good reasons not to have 8 different types of fire hydrants in your municipality. Although MMCD allows municipalities to choose from 8 or 10 or 12 types of hydrants, a municipality will typically say we're only going to use this one or this one. Supplementary standard details. There may be 8 types of curb profiles, but the municipality will standardize on 1 or 2 so that they don't have to have all of the tools for repairing curbs of multiple profiles. So these are pretty normal. Then there will be project-specific modifications, the invitation to tender, any special tendering instructions. For a while there, for instance, municipalities to get federal grant money had to, or maybe it was provincial grant money, had to be on the fair wage schedule. And so this would become a special tendering condition. What is the document that the tenders are to provide? What are the specific specifications or conditions that apply to the unique tender that we're talking about? And then, of course, the contract drawing. So the owner has a lot of stuff to put together. And as I mentioned earlier, unless both the unique and the project-specific changes are put into the existing classes in that document hierarchy, then additional classes in the document hierarchy need to be created to make sure there's no confusion where there are conflicts. We encourage municipalities to minimize the amount and type of changes they make to our document, because doing it poorly can create gaps where things have inadvertently been left out. It can create varying overlaps where you've said the same thing in two different ways. It can create order of precedent problems if the changes aren't made in the right document. For example, I had a call from a consultant who wanted to ensure that tenders paid specific attention to such and such. And he said, I want you to help me write the instructions to tender to do this. And I said, well, do you want this to apply throughout the contract? And he said, of course. This is why I'm bringing it to their attention. And so I said, well, don't put it in the instructions to tenders. Because if you go back to that slide where I looked at GC224, instructions to tenders are right at the bottom. And so there were other things in the contract that would, in the standard language, that would have overridden this. So the proper solution to that is to put a pointer in the instructions to tenders and say, bidders are reminded to pay particular attention to supplementary specification, blah, 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 dealing with blah, blah, blah. That way, you accomplish both goals. You get the bidder's attention that they have to look at this carefully, and you also get the document in the right place so that it supersedes the standard language that it's meant to. The other thing that can cause problems when owners and consultants don't modify the standard documents right is a mismatch in the units of measure between the specification section and the schedule of quantities and prices. And so this is another area where we really encourage owners and consultants to be particularly careful to make sure that what's said in one part of the document matches the schedule of quantities and prices. Because any time that we have any of these problems, they can lead to claims. And claims just waste a whole bunch of everybody's time. So we suggest that if your needs don't match the stated purposes of this niche market document, then you can modify it, but take really good care to make sure that when you modify it, you're doing it right, or use some other form of contract. CCDC has a whole variety of contracts, for instance. The Architectural Institute have standard contracts. We're not saying that our document should be used for everything. In fact, we're saying it should not. It's very specific. It does what it does very well, but it's not particularly suitable for things beyond its niche.